Good morning. Richard, you probably won't hear much about Bolivia, but now that you opened that door, I could stay longer and we could talk about Bolivia. We were there about 10 years, three different times with MCC, and then we finally settled in Calgary in 1996, and we've never left Calgary. And when I left MCC, the Food Grains Bank had an Alberta rep. Five of the provinces have a Food Grains Bank rep. Alberta had one, has had one for many years, and the one that was there recently became ill, and they asked if I would step in for a couple of months, and in December it will be 3 years of working with the Canadian Food Grains Bank, which isn't a big leap for someone who's worked many years with MCC, because MCC is one of the 15 members of the Food Grains Bank. You know a lot about that. But now I see Alberta through a much broader lens. When I was with MCC, I saw Alberta through primarily an MCC lens and a Mennonite lens, and I spoke in Mennonite churches quite often. But now I can, thank you very much. But now I see Alberta through the United Church, the Anglican and Catholic, the Christian Reformed, the Lutherans, the Adventists, the Baptists, the Pentecostal. Pentecostal is kind of the whole spectrum, but in the middle there is still the Mennonite group who founded the Food Grains Bank in the late 70s in response to what then was a famine in Ethiopia and Bangladesh. 1.5 million people died during that famine, and some farmers in the prairies, I say they were Alberta farmers, the Manitoba people say it was Manitoba, it really was Alberta, who started packaging grain and shipping it. And I always say, for farmers to have that kind of faith in the middle of a famine, which has not come through social media or the instant world news that we all have access to now, it came slowly back then. And they still had enough faith to organize, to pack grain, put it on ships and ship it over there, and still hope it might make a difference for some people, and I'm sure it did. But that is what all our work as Christians in any of these organizations and in our church work is about. It is about faith, however misplaced and inappropriate it might seem to us. So when Lisa contacted me about speaking here, I said, I'll do a sermon so long as I can also talk about the Food Grains Bank, and now I've almost used up that space. But I want to show 29 slides, and Mika said she would whip through them really quickly, but I want you to remember one thing, if you remember nothing else from these slides. One of our workers was recently in Sudan, which is the worst place of acute famine right now. 11 million people, really 33 million, but 11 million people in Sudan are suffering from acute food shortage, which means they are selling their assets. They're selling their goats or their cattle to feed their families, which means that next week they might not have goats or cattle to sell. If you're selling your half ton to feed your family, you're in trouble, right? We know that. So this staff person was in Sudan. Two of our leaders were there, and she sent a message back. She said, "We walked through a village." And she said, "I've walked through many villages in my life, but I've never walked through a village in any part of the world where there wasn't cooking going on." And she said, "We walked through an entire village, and there was no cooking going on in any of the homes." That's a stark comment about what hunger looks like when no one is cooking. So now we're going to show these slides quickly. Mika's going to do this really quickly. Whoops, go back. Sorry. Those are the 15 members. I won't run through them, but we're very grateful. The last two to join were in 2007, the Anglicans and the Catholics. It started with the Mennonites and a few others back in 1983, in the late 70s, and then in 1983, it became the Canadian Food Grains Bank rather than just the MCC Food Grains Bank, and that's when the first additional four members joined, and then it grew. Next. In the last 12 months, $75 million was spent on assistance for 1.1 million. Do the math. It's almost nothing. We spend like $60 or $70 per person. That's almost nothing. That doesn't feed people for a long period of time. So our resources are limited, and the help of people like you and the Canadian government is what makes it possible. Next. In 29, this is the comment I want to make here. In 2019, there were 9 conflicts in the world. 2024, there were 29 conflicts, all lasting more than 5 years. War is the biggest contributor to the shortage of food. Next. Countries most in need: Sudan, Lebanon, South Sudan. You can see them all. Lebanon, Syria, and Sudan are the most urgent now, but I would add to that quickly Nigeria and the Republic of Congo. And the cutbacks by USAID has made a huge difference in the resources that are now available. They are a lot less. Next. I show these pictures. My technical skills are limited. My brother was in Kenya recently. He works for the Food Grains Bank, and he sent these pictures by text. And if I was smarter, I would have made them look better. But they show up like this. The Food Grains Bank, the Canadian government, about 3 years ago, gave the Food Grains Bank additional money. They give us $25 million a year. But now they came to us and said, we have an additional $33 million if you raise $1.5 million. That's a really good deal. And so they said, but we want you to use it in East Africa to do soil reclamation work. But you can only have it for 3 years. And the Food Grains Bank rightly said, that's ridiculous. You can't do soil reclamation work in 3 years, except they do. And they've done amazing work. So this is an example of what it looks like or looked like after soil has been overgrazed. There has been drought, maybe flooding. It looks like that. Next. In one place that they visited, they had started to terrace as a response to this funding that they were getting. They started to terrace. They took the goats off and put them somewhere else. And in less than 3 years, a spring that had been dead, a natural spring, came to life. That spring now has enough water to feed the animals and the human beings in one entire village, just because they started terracing, planting trees, and taking the goats somewhere else so that it wasn't overgrazed. It's amazing how resilient our planet is to heal itself when we give it a chance. Next. A tree they planted 30,000, are planting 30,000 trees. This tree was planted 6 months ago. See how tall it is? That's how fast things grow when you give the earth a chance to do what it naturally wants to do. Terrace, plant legumes, get the goats somewhere else. And that's what happens next. And this is elephant grass, same thing. This area looked like that first picture a year and a half ago. Now it looks like this. It's amazing what we can do when we put our minds to it. And this is the people in East Africa making that happen. Next. The government gives us $25 million a year. We raise as much as we can. Those funds become available to all the 15 members. Each member raises their own funds. Also, donations are matched up to 4-to-1 to a maximum of $25 million. That number hasn't gone up since 2008. We wish the government would add to that. We're happy that they at least give that amount. Growing projects, and I'll show you a few in a minute, raise about half of what we raise in Canada. The remainder comes from churches, individual donors. Next. Last year, we had 31 growing projects, about 4,000 acres. They range all the way from La Crete in northern Alberta to Westfield, which is just north of Foremost, Alberta. So we have growing projects all over this province. Next. We lost a field at Trochu, one at Coaldale. A new project is being started at Andrew. Anybody know where Andrew is? Neither does anyone else. But it's just north of Mundare, and maybe you know where Mundare is. Anyway, it's northeast of Edmonton. I was there last week, and they're starting a new project there. And a little project here at DeWinton. Does anybody know the name Barry Dickison? I met with him last week. He has 20 acres of land, and he says they used to farm it for the Food Grains Bank. It's just south of DeWinton. And then he said, I know those people in First Mennonite, and he sent special greetings to Hartwig Wheeler. Is he here? He's not here. And Rudy Jansen. Anyway, he knows some other people here. There you are. Do you know him? Yes. Barry Dickinson, yes. So he's giving us 20 acres. We have to find somebody to farm it, right? You can't just have 20 acres and do nothing with it. Next, here's just some of what it looks like at harvest time. We all love harvest pictures. This is winter wheat in Medicine Hat last August. I felt so sorry for them. The revenue was 11 bushels per acre on wheat, and they felt badly, but 100 people showed up for the lunch. I always say, so not every project is really successful, but people still show up, and that really is what matters. We do what we can. The harvest is not always plentiful. Next. Leduc, they always put on a big show, and they love John Deere. Next. Legal near Westlock, that was a new project last year. I just took that picture because of the dust. I grew up on combines that didn't have cabs, and we drove into dust like that, and now we have cabs with air conditioning and computers. Next. That's the same combine, but I had to take that picture. Have you ever seen a 61-foot header? Those of you that farm, 61 feet. It's so long that sometimes it's hard to get it around the corners. Next. A lot of work, but this is a harvest at Carstairs. Some of you have been there. It happens every year around Thanksgiving. The Brown Ewart family puts that on. They have a young man, Xander, who with his grandfather brings out two threshers, and they seed it with horses. And they take it off with a binder, with an old tractor, and then they bring out this. And on that day, everyone can come, and they have pitchforks for you there if you want to participate. It's a lot of fun. They don't raise a lot. It's 8 acres of land. It takes them all afternoon to take that off, but they've done what they can, and they promote the need to end hunger in other countries. Next. Manning, Northern Alberta. Next. Bear Lake, which is really Grand Prairie. They have the right t-shirts and old combines. Most of the combines that do this work are pretty modern, but in that project, there are about a half a dozen what I call vintage gentlemen who bring out their vintage machines, and the oldest one they have is a 49 Cockshot, and none of them broke down last year, and they work all afternoon to take off what they can. That's how we used to farm. Next. Tabor, winter wheat. Next. La Crete, the farthest north project. Next. That's also La Crete. Next. This is an event in Tabor a month and a half ago. We had some speakers and we brought people together and had a supper. Next. Last, you don't have to be a farmer to contribute to the Food Grains Bank, as I've been saying. And this restaurant, if you want a really good burger, go to this place in Lacombe. They have a sister restaurant in Red Deer. And last December, for every burger that they have at what they call a chick, what do they call it? Pickled chicken burger. I've never had one, but they say it's great. So for everyone they sold, they donated $2 to the Food Grains Bank for the month of December. This restaurant picks a different charity every month of the year, and we got December. Next. And this is a fall lunch at High River Baptist. They have a huge event there every fall and every spring. It's a big deal. They have four different churches, but it's mostly the Baptists that come together. During the church service, they talk about the Food Grains Bank like I'm doing now, and then they have a big lunch afterwards with more presentations. Next. And this is Rimby, a big event that they have been doing for 19 years. I stumbled across it last year. I should have known about it. In the United Church, a woman leads a choir, and every December she brings these singers together for two nights of a concert, a Christmas concert, and they take up an offering for the Food Grains Bank. They've done it for 19 years. Last year they raised just over $6,000. A wonderful event. The church packs out with people from the community. Next. And that is our final instruction. And now, how am I doing for time, Lisa? So far, so good. I have a short message about I am the way. And I really don't have anything to say about what you said about joy in others, joy, except that I think it's a great sermon, that to find joy in other people's joy is sometimes the most difficult thing for us, even Christians. And if we became really good at that, we might become better at spreading the good news that Jesus is, to find joy in each other's joy. Before we were called Christians, the early followers were called simply followers of the way. That comes out of this chapter in John 14, but maybe also from how Jesus was talked about way back then. He was the way. There's a lot in these verses. In one of the most pivotal chapters in the Bible, Jesus is speaking to his disciples just before his crucifixion, providing reassurance and comfort on some level, even though it's likely that none of them understood what was about to happen to him. They are troubled because Jesus keeps hinting at it. He keeps saying and doing things that make them nervous. In chapter 13, he washes their feet. What's different about that? They don't get it, because this seemed to be about more than a normal foot washing. Foot washing was common in those days. They would have experienced it in other settings, but Jesus here in this little ceremony with them was upending the order they were expecting. The Messiah they had wanted was a winner, a fighter, and Jesus was showing them that it wasn't ever going to be like that. So really, how possibly could they have understood what was happening? In the same chapter, he predicts his betrayal, and out of nowhere, he tells Peter that he's going to betray him three times. In chapter 14, therefore, it's a kind of a farewell address to his disciples. Again, he tells them he is leaving, and they can't come with him, not yet at least. They ask where he is going, like, really? They thought he was staying. They will be dismayed and disoriented by what is about to happen to him over the next days, to their Messiah, and Jesus knows this. He gets this because for them, he knows it was never supposed to be like this. Most people, if they believed at all, still thought of him as the Messiah who might finally free them from bondage to the Romans. So even though they had spent 3 years with him, it would be hard for them to understand this other Jesus, the Jesus whom they would soon see dying on the cross, the same Jesus who is now telling them to put down their swords. This is all different for them. You would think that after 3 years, they would have figured a little more of it out. So don't be troubled, he says to them. Now, that's a strong message. Don't be troubled. Yes, they are troubled, he says to them. If you believe in me, you also know the Father. He's saying to them, I'm the whole package. He and the Father are one, which to the Jewish leaders, and they've heard them say this, was arrogant heresy, and yet Jesus was asking his followers to accept and maybe even to begin to understand this. Philip then says, show us the Father, and that will be enough. To which Jesus responds, if you know me, you know the Father. And that was always the point. Jesus was the Father. He's the way to the Father. This God who created everything, the one who connects atoms and neutrons and protons, who sets galaxies into an ever-expanding rhythm, this God becomes personal to us in the person of Jesus. We see God the Father when we see Jesus. Jesus is the only way we can know anything about God. And they are seeing God the Father in the Jesus they have hung around with for 3 years, and he's been trying to tell them about this. I'm very sympathetic to their confusion and their worry. We today have 2,000 years of study and learning and interpretation and translations, and we still are nearly always in agreement about what it all means. So then, maybe on behalf of all of us, Thomas asks the same question Peter asked in 13. We don't know where you are going, so how can we know the way? One preacher last week said, this may be the most controversial and important single verse in the Bible because Jesus finally says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And ever since that time, we have tried to understand what that means. Maybe it's enough just to know that it is Jesus, but that doesn't stop us from wondering and trying to sort it out. For example, Nicodemus in John chapter 3 asks about being born again, and Jesus says it's like the wind, we can't see it. He doesn't quite nail it down, but we still try anyway. Philippian jailer in Acts asks how he can be saved, and Paul says, believe and you and your house will be saved. The whole house will be saved if one person believes. That also doesn't quite make sense to us. A rich young ruler asks what he must do, and Jesus says to sell what he has and then to follow Jesus, and we have trouble with that as well. So it's important to note that Jesus does not say that he will show them the way here either, nor that he will explain it to them. He simply says, I am the way. I doubt we will ever quite understand this, but if we have ever experienced or witnessed the power of love anywhere in our lives, then I think we have an idea of what Jesus means when he says, I am the way. Jesus is not so much a way to someplace as he is a way to becoming what we are meant to be as human beings created in the image of God. We see the way in the person of Jesus. It is 100% a way of love. And then Jesus adds this. He says, that way also flows through us. Whoever believes in me, he says, will do what I do and even greater things. I used to think that must mean that I would be healing people and walking on water and raising people from the dead, the unusual things I often think of when I think of Jesus. He healed the sick, he turned water into wine, the blind and the lepers were healed, but he did other things. He met with tax collectors, he visited them in their houses, he fed people, he worried about those who are poor and noticed the people on the margins, and he reached out to them. Matthew 25, like other texts, talks about this way Jesus very clearly. It involves us. Feed the hungry, he says. Clothe those who are without clothes. Look after the widows and the orphans. All this is the Jesus way. So when Jesus says, I am the way, it means that we are part of that way. Not so much a way to a place, but a way to live with each other. When things are shaky around us, that feels extra important. But this way has always been the same. It's a way of love. Amen.